evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. At this time, we begin the segment on Limark, which is a gathering of enthusiastic guys in the New York City area that like to ask each other questions and find out how all this stuff really works. Radio propagation, antennas, and transmission lines, and transmitters, and receivers, and digital modes of operation, and meteor scatter, and moon bounce, and so on. It goes on and on and on. If you haven't already found out, you'll know that the radio art and science is a very complicated subject. And we amateurs try our best to break it down to more simple terms so it's more understandable. But if you really want to be good at it, it takes quite an investment, quite a period of time. To be a good radio person, to be a good antenna engineer or whatever, we're talking about something like a decade or more. There's a lot of brain power in the New York City area, and we think we're tapping into that when people come onto this TechNet, which covers the tri-state area, pose a question, and quite frequently somebody in that listening audience has some experience in that area and gives us the wisdom of their experience. So Mel and Dick try to act as a group leader, interlocutor, it's not a company we're leading. It's a very loosely defined group of people that try to help each other. Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee, and Dick, K2 RIW, are the guys who've been running this thing for quite a long period of time. There is no guarantee that you're going to get accurate answers right away. I mean, everybody has a batting average. Let me drop it. Nobody bats 1,000, and we all make mistakes, so be careful. Occasionally, some of the things you're going to hear have some inaccuracy. Like to believe, though, I like to believe, just like a peer-reviewed journal, that by way of the inaccuracy being exposed, somebody comes forward and says, gee, hey, Dick, you said so-and-so yesterday, and I think it's really this way instead. And given the evidence, we'll admit those errors and go forward. So be careful. Everything you hear the first time, not always 100% accurate, but eventually it does become more accurate, it says here. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in simply because you're listening. By now, after 28 years, this is TechNet number 1,349. By now, we believe that somebody must be listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. A typical sign-in would sound like this. WB2TCC, Rich and Yes. I'm having some fun with Rich. His real call letters are N2EO. So, give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
N2EO, Rich and Yes. You remember my old call, huh, Dick?
Yeah. I had to look it up. My memory's not quite that good, Rich. Okay, Rich is number one. Who else would like to sign in because they've got a question or a comment? Call letters and name, please.
KC2DIPSYQ, Yes.
N2ATG, David, yes.
Fulton with a yes for a space report. Down somewhere after, maybe after Mel. W after Mel.
K2WGB, John, yes.
Okay.
Ben, yes.
We picked up Matt, can't read my own writing here, Paul, and I believe Dave, N2APG, in that list, along with John. Let's see, I've got to put these numbers here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, John and Wesley, we've got, okay, so far we've got Rich.
That was Michael, not Matt.
Shows you what I know, Mike. In other words, WIQ, I think you're saying, is Michael, very good. So we've got Rich, Mike, Paul, Dave, John, Wesley. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
Joe.
Okay, that was a double. I heard Joe. What were your call letters, Joe?
Kilo Golf 2 Tango, KG Duty.
Okay, we got Kilo Golf 2 Tango, and who was the other person?
Your old buddy, K2KEY.
Never heard of him. That was Mel. Okay. Rich, N2EO, he sent me an email with reference to a very nice amplifier. When you go and look at that, let me see if I've got that still on my website here. Yes, I do. Beko, B-E-K-O, is a company that makes a very nice 300-watt, 500-watt, kilowatt, 1500-watt solid-state amplifier. And they build them for 6 meters, 2 meters, 432, and so on. Beautiful-looking piece of equipment. A little bit on the pricey side. $3,500, I think, is the $1,500 one. And Rich really wants to know, should he switch over, being a really modern guy, should he switch over from tube amplifiers to solid-state amplifiers? I got a lot of opinions on this one. Let me drop. If you're in the 100-watt class of amplifiers, your Mirage-like amplifiers, Mirage Baker 216, I think, for instance, the one where you put 2 watts in and get 160 watts out, it's a package about 10 inches long and about 4 inches wide and about 3 inches high, and you give it 12 volts, and out comes 160 watts with 2 watts of drive. Beautiful solid-state thing to be used for a mobile. And so if you want to run high power from your mobile, except for the fact that you got to be a little bit careful with the way you do the dressing of the 12-volt wiring, because it's going to draw something like 20 amperes of 12 volts, and you've got to have the right kind of twisted pair, red and black wire going all the way back to the battery to make sure it's not radiating lots of 2-meter energy into the car and disturbing the automobile computers for the display panel and for the emission control system and whatever. So in an environment like that, or to run one of those from your house with a 20 or 30 ampere power supply. The nice thing about solid state is it's a little bit more compact and instant on. You don't have to wait for the heating of a tube. So at the 100 watt class, I like solid state amplifiers. I've used them, and within reason, they do a pretty good job. Let me drop. However, now when you get to the kilowatt class, the 800 watt, 1000 watt, 1500 watt class of solid state amplifiers, now I've got mixed feelings on that. I'm going to also pass this over to Mel, because I bet you he's a pretty modern guy. He likes using solid-state equipment. And when it comes to kilowatt class, 1,000-watt, 1,500-watt peak envelope power and beyond solid-state amplifiers, now life gets more difficult for about three reasons. Number one, they are not really more compact. It's still a pretty darn big package. When you're trying to run that kind of power, let's say, for instance, you're doing it with 28-volt transistors, and you want to run 1,000 watts of output. With the usual efficiency, you're going to probably have to put something like 1,800 watts of input. Therefore, you're going to need 100 amperes of 28 volts to feed those transistor collectors. And if you study what's required to make a, let's say, a 3,800-volt power supply for a tube-type amplifier at the kilowatt class, fairly conventional oil-filled capacitors, available transformers, fairly simple schematic diagram-wise filter networks can do a pretty good job of rectifying the power, filtering it, and supplying it to the tubes. You start designing a 100-ampere, 28-volt or so power supply, and you try to have good filtering, good rectification, good regulation, now life gets complicated. That's not a simple circuit anymore with all the right kind of protection. Solid-state amplifiers also, the barefoot amplifier, cannot tolerate a short circuit or an open circuit. Let me drop. Yeah, I'm going to pass it over to Eric also. But a tube-type amplifier, you can put a dead short or an open on it, and it'll take it. Solid-state amplifiers, quite often you're going to burn up the silicon in milliseconds. Yes, you can build in protection networks that look at reverse power and start doing protection, but it's quite a bit more complicated. So would I just jump right over immediately to a solid-state amplifier because it's available? If I had a lot of money in my pocket and it's burning a hole, I guess I would do it. But most of us are a little bit more conservative than that. Now, you've run multi-kilowatt. I'm going to switch the order a little bit here. I'm going to go over to Eric first. Because by way of the broadcast transmitters you've run some extremely high power solid-state amplifiers with these 100-ampere and 200-ampere type regulator networks. What's your feeling on, is it worth all the extra dollars to not gain a whole lot of improvement in size and just to gain instant on? Would you really be willing to switch over? How many of these kilowatt class of power supplies of a ham radio nature are in your shack, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the tech net.
First of all, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Your audio is a little bit low, your hum's a little bit high, but we're all hearing you, so please proceed, Eric.
Alright, let me just point out, K2RIW, that most kilowatt-type amplifiers use 50-volt transistors as opposed to 28-volt, so that's the baseline. So it makes the power supply a little bit easier. If you're doing FM only, you're running Class C regulation in broadcast transmitters, don't put too much energy into that. So, I run multi-kilowatt amplifiers. I actually run boards that run a kilowatt and a half on each board. And basically, it's a broadcast transmitter, so it's a center tapped 50-volt transformer that's used for the power supply. It dials capacitors, and they don't really care too much about regulation. They expect that the line voltage is going to be somewhat regulated. So that's one aspect of it. I'll tell you this much, solid-state amplifiers are very rugged when they're properly designed, but that's the question, are they properly designed? I mean, my transmitters can deal with lightning strikes, no less, amongst things, and it's very rare that I lose an output transistor from that. I gotta say that the solid-state technology is getting better and better in terms of the tests that they're coming up with now. One transistor is 600 watts, so all you got to do is have good heat sinking. But I'll tell you, a tube is just as much fun as a solid-state amplifier, but there's more work involved with the tube, whereas the solid-state amplifier, you basically turn it on, and if you don't have any shorts, you don't have any protection circuits that are kicking in. Whereas with the tube, of course, you got to give it a little TLC and make sure it's tuned properly and it's biased right. But I like both, so, it depends on what you're doing. Today's transistors, Class AB, not a problem. You want a little better regulation than you do if you're doing Class C, but it can be a lot of fun.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, we lost about 15 seconds at the end there, Eric. So if you were home brewing, do you believe a person without a whole lot of experience would find it more or less challenging to build a kilowatt class solid state amplifier as opposed to a tube type solid state amplifier if you're home brewing? I mean, the good news is that Rich is a little bit better off than many of us, and he's willing to spend what many of us will call a significant amount of money. Let's call it $3,500 for an amplifier. Not many of us will be willing to do that, and we'd like to home brew it and save half that money if possible. When it comes to home brewing, do you believe we could solid-state home brew with equal degree of difficulty? What's your feeling on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
That's kind of a cloned question. It's a little bit of a double-edged sword. Whereas if you're going to home brew a tube, you need some mechanical skills. You need to be able to mount tube sockets and chimney and make a plate network and all that stuff. Really, the only thing you need with solid state is either you can use somebody else's design, get a board, and just solder the parts down. That's one way to go. The other is you need a little bit of software. You need to do some math to create the output filter. That's the hardest part. The mechanics are much less. The basic layout is a lot easier. So, really all depends upon your skill set. I would actually find making a solid state amplifier a heck of a lot easier than building a tube amplifier, that's for sure, mechanically. electronically, if I'm designing it from scratch, the tube is easier to make. It's fine. The solid state, the networks, it's a little bit more intricate because you're pretty much going to build the output network on the board. So there's a couple pieces of software that make that whole task really easy. It'll actually give you the output network and the actual physical layout on a PC board. So, you know, flip a coin, Dick. HRWK2J.
Okay, you're hearing the voice of a man, Eric, K2EJ, who has run broadcast transmitters at the many, many kilowatt level, solid state, and so he's got a much more positive opinion about them, their reliability and their degree of difficulty of construction. I've done much less of it, and you can tell I'm a little bit more negative. Now, maybe we've got a more objective person here in the case of Mel. I'll bet you some of the guys in the Kings County Radio Club have considered buying or building high-power solid-state. And we're talking about kilowatt class here now, Mel, so what's your feeling on this? K2KEY, if you wanted a 1,500-watt PEP amplifier, would you consider tubes first or solid-state first? You got it, Mel, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, the way I look at it, I guess I've been both ways. You know, I've homebrewed kilowatt amplifiers for a long time using, of course, all kinds of tube technology, whether it be the old bottles from World War II, like my first big amp, which was a 813. And then basically, you know, I branched into the IMAX ceramic tubes as they came out. And that's currently what I'm running now. I have a couple of amplifiers running the newer version of the higher power amplifier tube that, of course, IMAX pioneered. When I'm not carrying it around, if it doesn't have to be carried around, the mobile, whatever it is, even though I've had a kilowatt in the mobile with tubes, with a couple of good old 4X 250s. The homebrew version of my, I built a 6-meter, 300-watt solid state. Let me let it drop and I'll describe it. Okay, I was able to get a hold of some nice MOSFET linear transistors. And with them, what's nice about low drive, for instance, put in 15 watts of PEP, get 300 watts out of the module. Module's fairly easy to put together. Nice part about it, it doesn't require as much current because the circuit was developed to run on 85 volts. So the power supply was somewhat simplified. However, when you get into the kilowatt class, if you have, like Eric said, the ingenuity to be able to do some mechanical work, it's really a toss-up what your pockets would willing to spend. I would think in today's modern age, Dick, that you're most likely going to be able to homebrew solid-state amplifiers, especially the way the transistors are coming, came down in price and what's available today, cheaper than you will do with tubes. The tube technology has moved away from most everything except amateur radio. So let me let it drop one more time. And so with the moving away, the components have really gotten up in price. You take old components, gee, you never thought things like variable capacitors, the old ones, and the sockets and things like that, you know, have gone up so high, plate transformers, things just so high now. So a homebrew, a kilowatt rig amplifier today could basically cost you more than it would in a solid state. However, going out and purchasing, that's a whole other story. You know, the big difference between the commercial market and the amateur radio market, first of all. And number two, you remember, it's a small, small market, so you pay a heck of a lot of money for development and also for advertising and all. A good part of that money is what goes into these piece of equipment that you see, because parts-wise, it's not a fraction of what the final prices pick over.
WI2U with a comment.
Red 2XN with a comment.
Okay, Mike and Wesley in that order. Thank you very much, Mel. So you've been on both sides of the fence. And Mike, how many kilowatt class solid state amplifiers have you built or have your friends built? And are they happy with building homebrew solid state or buying homebrew kilowatt class solid state as opposed to tube types? WI2U, K2RIW, you got a mic.
Okay, Dick, and good evening all. Well, as you know, in a former life, I was the engineering manager over at Microwave Power Devices at MPD. We built, multi-octave band amplifiers and multi-kilowatt band amplifiers. I guess the biggest thing MPD that I've ever done is a 30-kilowatt amplifier. You heard that correct, solid state. 256 devices in parallel, from 100 megahertz to 500 megahertz with harmonic filtering built in. And I did a number of HF amplifiers also in the multi-kilowatt range, 1.5 to 30. Interestingly enough, I'm of the opinion that a solid-state amplifier can be built pretty reasonably, pretty cheaply. And the part that I'm thinking of, I hope I have the part number right, it's been so long. It's actually a circuit that was developed by the application engineer, Helge Granberg, maybe you've heard of him. Just somebody Google his name, and you'll probably end up, the first hit would be his HF amplifier using the MRF-157. It's a single-ended transistor. Two of them in push-pull should give you about 600 watts easy, with about 24 dB of gain. Let me drop a minute. And 56-volt power supply, that's about 65% efficient, I think you can get pretty easily. Again, two in push-pull, he designs the whole thing for you, input transformers, output transformers, the whole thing, including the bias network. They're biased AB, so they're linear. If you wanted to combine four transistors, two in push-pull combining with two in push-pull, you could easily get 1,100 watts CW out of it. The biggest thing about the challenge of designing a, in my opinion, an HF amplifier is getting the heat out of the devices. These devices have plenty of gain. They have 24 dB of gain, which is probably too much gain. The input is not very well matched, but since you've got so much gain, you can probably throw away much of the excess output from a 100-watt class amplifier in like a 6 dB or even an 8 dB pad, so the radio would see a good match going into the amplifier. The bad news is, of course, you have to do your own filtering at the output. I think you're going to need six bands, if I broke these bands out correctly, because the harmonic content, especially the third harmonic, these things operate pretty close to saturation, is pretty high. So if you broke the bands up something like this, 1.5 to 2.5, one band, let me drop a minute. 2.5 to 4 megahertz would be another band, 4 to 7, the third band, 7 to 12, 12 to 21, and finally 21 to 30. You'd need some kind of an arrangement that has switching to switch in six low-pass filters of some sort behind the amplifier to make yourself within FCC requirements. But I don't think the challenge is that significant, nor do I think the cost is that significant. Again, a 56-watt power supply capable of about 2,000 watts should drive it with ease. And again, if anybody wants to Google it, Helge Granberg, and I got a good feeling that the first hit you're going to get is going to be his solid-state amplifier. So back to you there, Dick, see if you need any fills. K2RIW and the net, WI2U.
By the way, the Motorola transistor value, I think it's application note AN261 is his amplifier. Most of the book is written by him anyway.
That's it. Thank you.
Excellent. There's a man who's done it. Been there, done that. And you were doing it as a commercial product, and you were backed up by a good-sized engineering department with George, W2KRM. From the mechanical engineering department, making sure you had some good heat sinking while you were doing all that work over there at Microwave Power Devices there, Mike. And I noticed that to do all that combining of all of those transistors at each of those frequency bands, that's a fair amount of switching. You did say that to get the kind of power output you're talking about, you're kind of close to saturation. And if I know for a fact that Rich N2EO, who asked the original question, who we haven't let him talk yet, but he told me ahead of time what the question's going to be. I know he's primarily interested in linear single sideband service. where he would like the third order intermodulation to be kind of low. So when it comes to using the right kind of feedback, the right kind of neutralization stability, so he's getting reasonable linearity, so he's getting reasonable rejection of third order intermod products, and it's not just a Class C FM type service, does that add any extra degree of difficulty from your point of view, having been there, Mike? WY2U, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Oh, no negative, Dick. This is a Class AB amplifier. I should say it's operating at saturation. It's operating close to saturation, probably at about 1 dB back off from compression. And by the way, these are FETs. The third order intermodulation distortion, two-tone from what I recall, should be about 36 dB below PEP. That would make it more than adequate for single sideband service, Dick. Go ahead.
Okay, we're hearing more and more good news. I know that Wesley wanted to add a question to this. Go right ahead, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. Good evening, everybody. It is not really the question, but a comment. As you all know, I don't buy anything new, and I don't buy anything expensive. Most of the stuff that I have purchased, I was able to acquire for 1% or 3% of the price, original price. And that is not difficult. It's just hunting for the right price. Now, what is more difficult? To have a mechanical skills or just to buy something that has already the mechanics and just play with it? Now, you have a pleasure just to educate yourself and play with it. So let me give you a few examples. Alpha amplifier. This or really big amplifiers and really big power. Well, Alpha Amplifier 76. If you want to buy it right now, it's $1,500. And all you need is probably change the tubes. Now, if you want to hunt on it, I've seen this for $450. You want to play with Collins 30L. $799, I found one for $140. Now, if you want to have a solid state, 300 watt amplifier, $269, but you can get it for about $70 if you want to. Now, what is good about having tubes? AMAC 3 CX 1500A7, $202.50. So, if you have a good quality amplifier, then changing the tubes is not much difficult. You don't have to have mechanical skills. Now, another one. Henry. Henry had a good history. Henry 2K class HF amplifier. If you like, you can get it for $124.95 in non-working condition. Now, if you want to go with any other element that you need, let's say the amplifier switch, because you need one, because it's not working properly, $49.99. But if you want to have something like not really extra very big power, but solid state, $41 polymer to linear amplifier, good around 200 watts, and so on and so on. Now, if you go further, there is one, Helicopters, HT41. This was a good history of United States of America in ham radio history. $1. And to XGN, back to you.
So what Wesley is telling us is that as long as you're willing to go to slightly older equipment, there's some real good bargains out there. We're going to have to move along a little bit faster. We're getting a little bit behind here, Rich, but as you can tell, there's all kinds of opinions on where you are. Go a little bit slow, because you're about to invest a fair number of dollars. You've already perfected the problems of getting 208 or 240 volts into your tube-type kilowatt amplifier that you now own. And I'm wondering, are you really going to gain enough size, reliability, or whatever when you switch over to the solid-state kilowatt class from where you are. So my first suggestion is go slow, because I think you're investing a fair number of dollars, and I don't think you're a really rich guy, but maybe you are. N2EO, the guy who asked the original question, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Okay, Dick. No, I'm not rich. N2EO. I think you've got a few things confused. The 8877 amplifier that I worked on, I'm hanging on to that. That's an HF amplifier. These Bicos, that's the way it's pronounced, Bico, from Germany, are solid state for 2 meters, 70 centimeters, and 6 meters. So I think some people are getting a little mixing apples and oranges here. I'm not sure which way I'm going to go, Dick. The reason I'm thinking of buying instead of building, let me let it reset. I've been doing a lot of building over the last 3 years, converting this amplifier with a second 8877, all the Collins restorations, and all the other stuff. So I'm kind of about burnt out with building. I've been coming down here and doing it, building and refurbishing, mainly refurbishing, but that's building. I've been doing it now for 3 years and want to take a little bit of a rest. And the reason I was thinking of the solid state was because they're going to sit in the corner pretty much where I can't get to them too easily. The other side of the room, aside from the operating table. All right, we're going to give it some thought. Not spending the money tomorrow, as I told you, probably after Christmas. And I'm also looking at some tube amplifiers by Lunar Link, run by K1FO, the pair of three CX800s. That he's got the same price range. Back to that, and let you go on to K2RIW, Technet Limark, and 2EO.
Yeah, good luck with that project, Rich, and keep us informed. Mike was the next person who signed in. Mike number one, KC2 Whiskey, India, Quebec. What would you like to discuss tonight, Mike? K2RIW, my name is Dick.
It's KC2 WIQ, Dick.
Okay, KC2, Whiskey, Yankee, Quebec, I think it is. Go right ahead. Matt, I think it is. Go right ahead. Or Matt or Mike, you got it, sir.
No, it's Michael. I'm having trouble with my display. My display is holding a C for number one. I don't know why. It should be holding a number one for channel one, but it's holding a C. I'm working on a Radio Shack HTX212 2 meter transmitter.
Okay, HTX. I think HTX202 is a very popular rig. I think you said HTX212. You're having trouble with the display. Can you give us a few more words? What is the display doing that you're unhappy with, Mike? Go ahead.
Well, what it's supposed to be seeing number one, but it is showing a C.
Supposed to be showing C number one, and it's just showing C. Is that what you said, Mike?
What? No, it's supposed to be showing number one, but instead of number one, it is showing a C. I don't know what the C is for.
It's a call channel. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Is that you, Dave?
Negative N2FLF.
N2FLF, I think you said. Give us your call, your name, a little more slowly. And in other words, he's getting the indication of a call channel. In other words, I think you're saying he's in a mode of operation different from the normal mode of operation. So go slowly, sir, and give us a little more information.
My name is Mark, N2FLF. Hey, Mike, you probably hit a button somewhere that says call on it, C-A-L-L, and that puts the radio in a different channeling sequence, so to speak. What you should be able to do, if you hit the memory recall button, the MR button, that possibly will bring you back to your normal memory channels. Dick?
Okay, thank you, Mark. I wonder, Mike, does that make some sense to you, that... you can hit the memory recall, MR, function, and maybe it'll get you out of that call channel function. KC2WYQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I'm going to try it.
Okay, good luck, and let us know how that works out. Paul, WS2N, I think you're telling us you've got a space report, and maybe you also have a question. WS2N, K2RAW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, I had a space report, but I thought I would go after now, but that's fine with me if you want to do it. No question at this time, so your choice, Dick.
Okay. Sometimes you sign in with both a question and a space report. And so we're going to hold off with the space report, and thank goodness you've got one. The next person who signed in was Dave, N2APG. Go right ahead with your question, Dave. What's going on there in Massapequa?
Yeah, hi, Dick, N2APG. Well, besides trying to garner the market on used Fujinon binoculars to repair, I have a question about some rubber duck antennas. Not only rubber duck antennas, but some telescopic whip antennas. Over the years, I have accumulated a nice box full of rubber-type antennas and things like that, having an affinity for handy talkies. And my question has to do with those antennas that are not easily identifiable. You know, you buy a box of antennas at a ham fest for, 10 antennas for $2 or something like that, and you bring it home and you toss it aside, and eventually you say to yourself, what should I do with these antennas? Can they be used? Can I put them on a handy talkie and use them? So the question is there an easy way, maybe down and dirty method of determining what frequency these unidentified antennas could be used for? I don't have a lot of special technical equipment or anything like that. So just, and does it even pay to even play with them? Does it, maybe it doesn't even pay to spend the time and effort to try to figure out what they're for?
And to Leo.
Yeah, I think it definitely pays to play with them. Have you been down this road? I've got two separate answers for Dave, but let's see what Rich got. I wonder if you run into that one, Rich. N2EL, K2RIW.
Well, I haven't, Dick, but what comes to mind when he said it, I would say two ways. The easy way, if you got it, is to use an MFJ antenna analyzer and look for sweep it for a one-to-one match. But in lieu of that, I would say $30-$40 Grizzit meter, put a load on the BMC connector and use a Grizzit meter and see where it's resonant.
That might work. If you had a ground plane, a sheet of metal with a hole in the center where you've got a connector, and you connect these rubber ducks to that, and then from the other side you've got the coaxial input connector, and you connect it to some kind of a antenna analyzer is one approach, or just a Viswa meter, just measure forward power and reverse power when you put 6 meter, 2 meter, and 70 centimeter energy into the antenna. There's a little bit of a catch here though. And that is, you'll notice that when you're at a flea market and you're buying a rubber duck, you say, hey, I want a 2 meter rubber duck for my handy talkie, and the guy says, okay. Thank you.
Timeout. Repeat.
That was 10 over 9 at my QTH, and I can tell by the strength of what was getting into the Limark repeater at Glen Oaks, that person was within a fraction of a mile of the repeater throughout most of that slow mobile operation. When it comes to those rubber ducks, Dave, and if you connect them to a ground plane and sweep them in frequency and find out which frequencies they give you a reason. Dave, is that the individual antennas are slightly different depending on the brand of radio they're going to. When you're at a flea market, you tell the guy you want to buy a rubber. The first brand is your hand duck, because each manufacturer tunes the final stage a little bit differently. So, ordinarily, you'd be looking for something like a 1.1 Vizwire. Well, maybe a 2-to-1 Vizwire is good enough, if you know what I mean, because, as I said, each manufacturer has got a slight different way that they do the impedance matching. They don't assume that the antenna is a pure 50-ohm load, because the feed line inside the handy talkie is such a short distance. So, testing them with any kind of an antenna analyzer or a standing wave ratio bridge by feeding power into them on a standard ground plane is a way to go. And you got to be a little bit liberal on how you judge whether or not it is exactly tuned to that frequency for your particular radio's method of impedance matching. One of them makes some sense, Dave. N2APG, K2RIW in the DECnet.
Okay, I was considering something like that, you know, using maybe an SWR meter. I've never used a grid dip meter before, but that's possibly something, you know, to get into. I wonder also, maybe a noise bridge, would that have the same, you know, type of thing? You know, I'm not going to go out and spend $400, you know, on an antenna analyzer just to analyze a couple of used rubber duck antennas. However, you know, that's also a possibility to pick up an antenna analyzer and to use that for other things as well. But yeah, it's just a question. I'm sure a lot of hams have, you know, a box of rubber ducks that sitting around, and you know, they're fine, I guess, for scanner antennas where you're just listening. But maybe you want to, you know, put one on a radio that you pick up at a garage sale or something like that, and you know, you're not sure, is this a VHF antenna, is it a UHF antenna, or is it some wacky, you know, antenna that's useless, you know, for us hams. So So that was my that was my basic question. Back to you, Dick, and to APG.
A properly used noise analyzer or properly used antenna analyzer will tell you the real information, the resistor component and the reactor component at each frequency. You probably don't need that degree of information, just a simple standing wave ratio bridge of some kind, even a Berg wattmeter, where you measure forward power and reverse power, and where the reverse power goes to a minimum, you and I would call that resonance, and it's close enough. So it could be done with fairly simple instrumentation, and I bet you're going to find out quite a few of those rubber ducks you've collected over the years, and also those telescoping antennas at certain lengths of the telescope are going to serve on your 2-meter or 70-centimeter operation. How soon do you intend to start making those measurements, Dave, and do you have some kind of simple standing wave ratio bridge? Over to you, Dave.
I think I have a couple of SWR-type meters. You know, again, the question is, would they be... I think most of them are designed for HF use, below 30 megahertz. I think I have one or two that's specifically designed for VHF, UHF. So those are probably the ones I would, you know, utilize for this type of testing. And, you know, it's just something, with some time on my hands, it's something that occurred that perhaps I would be interesting to try to identify that what frequency, what bands, you know, some of these antennas are for. And, you know, again, whether or not they could be used or they should just be put in a separate box labeled receive only.
You got to be a little bit careful with the HF-type standing wave ratio meters. I own a standing wave ratio meter that's rated for 80 through 10 meters. I remember using it on 6 meters, and I got moderately good results. I tried then using it on 2 meters. And the results really became spooky. It wasn't designed for that frequency range. And I could tell the rectifier was having grief because as I put a small amount of power into it, it became too sensitive, but a small amount of power into it, the needle would dance around because the rectifier network was heating up and the needle would jump down to zero, it would cool off and it would start giving me a reading again and so on. It became intermittent. So try to use a standing wave ratio meter that's approximately for the right frequency range. The next person who signed in was, I guess it was John. You probably have one of the simple questions for the first hour, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick. Good evening, Dick and Mel, and everybody else on the net. Maybe after Mel, I see we're getting close to 9. I need you to describe, if you can, the losses in waveguide and the cause and effects. Pretty simple, I think.
Depending on how deep you want to go, waveguide is not simple. To that wave that's going down a guide, believe it or not, as long as you're feeding the right frequency down there, it thinks it's in a absolutely free space. I talked to that wave, and that's what it told me. If you walk into a good-sized barbershop who's got mirrors on the left-hand wall and the right-hand wall, and you're looking down the center of that barbershop and you see about 8 chairs, depending on if you look into the mirrors at a 45-degree angle, you may see the barber 5 times in a row, if you know what I mean, because of those reflections. A waveguide behaves exactly like that. That signal bounces back and forth between the narrow walls, not the broad walls. It zigzags back and forth, and the method that the signal goes down the waveguide is, if you've got waveguide of high enough quality, good silver plating on the walls, properly designed, you're using it within the right frequency range, it is fairly low in insertion loss and fairly high in power capability. Let me drop. But there's a catch. Almost any of the available transmission lines, whether they be coax, waveguide, and in some cases twin lead, for the first 100 feet or so, it works like a charm. Therefore, if a person owned a piece of property where he's got a hill in the back of his property half a mile away, and he's going to get a lot more altitude if he puts a antenna on top of a tower on top of the hill, and now he's going to run a transmission line half a mile. Common sense would lead you to believe that as long as I get low enough feed line loss, that should give me a great advantage. In fact, that's one of the articles that's in the latest issue, the June issue of QST Magazine, under, I think it's Technical Topics, or this question and answer section, and you actually look up the real insertion loss at the proper operating frequencies for your coax or your waveguide, and half a mile of it, you'll find that the total amount of loss starts building up real fast. The nasty thing about waveguide and transmission line is that the loss is linear, not exponential. In other words, we talk about dBs per 100 feet, and if it was 1 dB per 100 feet, it's going to be 2 dB per 200 feet, it's going to be 10 dB per 1,000 feet, and so on. Linear relationship. Whereas transmitting a real signal in air is a square law relationship. Every time you double the distance, you get 6 dB more loss. Well, once you start getting out to long ranges, through the air, insertion loss doesn't build up anywhere near as fast as it would. And that's the reason why one of my physics puzzles is a waveguide to the moon. How much loss would you get? And boy, do you get surprising answers on that. So, waveguide, let me drop one more thing I'm going to tell you.
Isn't it 3 dB when you double the distance?
I think that was Barry, and he's asking, do you get 3 dB every time you double distance? And the answer is no. That's a good common sense question. I'm glad you asked it. If I had 3 dB of loss for the first 100 feet, and I double it to 200 feet, do I get 3 dB more loss? Yes. 600, that would be 6 dB total. Then if I doubled the distance again, from 600 feet to 1,200 feet, you would think you get 3 dB more loss in transmission line. No. It gets 6 dB more loss. Because it is a linear relationship. Every 100 feet would be 3 dB. So if I go 400 feet, I would have 3 times 4, 12 dB of loss, if you know what I mean. I may have done the math wrong, but you know what I'm talking about. So, in free space, it's 6 dB more loss every time you double distance. In the case of waveguide, it's X number of dB loss per 100 feet, a linear relationship. So if you start getting out to distances like a mile, those dBs build up real fast with waveguide, whereas in free space, it doesn't build up quite as fast. That's part of the reason why a periscope antenna system works so well. It's a so-called beam waveguide system. That's one of these antennas where you got a dish on the ground, aimed up at a fly swatter on the top of the tower, and the fly swatter is tilted at a 45-degree angle and bends the signal out over to the horizon. Waveguide, as I said, if you use not too much of it, gives you very low loss and it works very well and extremely well shielded. But there's another catch, and that is the horizontal maximum dimension of that guide has to be exactly a half wavelength or less at your operating frequency. In other words, the waveguide's got to be larger in dimension than half wavelength. If your waveguide is 0.4 wavelength wide instead of 0.5 or greater, it'll have a huge amount of loss. The signal just doesn't go down there at all. You study what's really going on. Let me drop. To discover that once you know the dimension of the waveguide, once you know that the frequency you're sending down it, there's some mathematics that'll tell you exactly at what angle does the signal zigzag down that waveguide by bouncing left and right off those narrow height walls when you've got the waveguide laying flat on the table with the broad wall flat on the table. It zigzags left and right, and there is an exact angle for each frequency that the waveguide works at. And if you go lower in frequency where the wavelength gets bigger, and so that you know your waveguide is no longer half wavelength wide, the bounce angle goes to 90 degrees. In other words, the signal bounces back and forth at a 90-degree angle. It makes no forward progress, and you get a huge amount of loss per a very small number of inches. That's how the attenuator works on a Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator. It's a circular piece of wave operating beyond waveguide, the waveguide beyond cutoff, as they call it. And so a few inches of that circular guide and that step on that piston attenuator that's on the output of your Hewlett-Packard 608 signal generator, a few inches gives you 120 decibels of loss, and it's a very calibratable loss per inch of length. So this is a thumbnail sketch. If you get the microwave handbook from ARRL, they give you a lot more information with some nice diagrams, a little bit more understandable. Waveguide is not simple. You just heard 3% of the story, if you know what I mean, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Thank you. That's interesting. I'm going to look into that. I think I will order that book. All right? Back to that.
I call it the Waveguide Handbook. That's not the exact title, but we'll eventually find the right title for it. It's a $20 book. I hope it's still in print. It's got about 20 or 30 chapters, very nicely done, the ARRL handbook, with some good illustrations. Let's see now. I think it's time we go over to the mailbag. Mel, what kind of burning questions have you had this week? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, funny you should ask, because I'm just looking now. To use these crystals, and I found that in solid state version of my generator, they don't work. I want to use them for markers. Why don't they work? Even though my friend put them into an old crystal, an old generator of the tube type, and the crystals work perfectly. Why don't they work in the solid state equipment? Oh, yes, that's typical. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, you're the guy who went and bought a whole lot of crystals to build yourself a lattice filter. You went and built up test equipment so you could measure the series resistor equivalent and the exact frequency of resonance for these crystals. So when it comes to the series cut, the parallel cut, the circuit, the kind of crystals that are intended for a Colpitts oscillator, a clap oscillator, and so on, you're the guy who's been there and done that, so I bet you know the answer to this one. I think I don't. A smart guy knows what he doesn't know, Mel, and I don't know the answer to this one. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, having experience, the only reason I know, Dick, like you say, because I fooled around with, got myself into, you know, enough headaches. The crystals, of course, that I wound up using in that Butterworth filter that I built, are, of course, modern crystals, you know, not of the old World War II clunkers that plugged in, the PR or whatever they used to call those cases. I've used ones, you know, the new, known as the monolithic crystals, and old crystals. All right, why did they work? I had a number of them. Still have a whole box full of them. Why don't they work? Why didn't they work? I had to find out. I found that they are rather lossy. I think I measured now. Remember, going back years now, getting old there, kiddo. You're a young man, but I'm getting a little older. 7,000 to 10,000 ohms of series resistance was not unusual in those crystals. So a solid-state circuit, unless it has enough gain to overcome this rather high loss, I think would give you a problem. That's what I think I found, Dick. Over.
So if I understand you correctly, Mel, a tube-type oscillator, the actual feedback gain, by the way, almost every oscillator, believe it or not, when you really analyze it, you'll find out that an oscillator consists of an amplifying circuit with some of the output of the amplifier being fed back to the input, usually with some kind of tuning. But normally you adjust things in such a way so that the signal being fed back is in phase with what that amplifier wants to see in order to keep reproducing that signal. And when you analyze the circuit and you walk around the loop at least once, you walk through the amplifier, and let's assume that your amplifying tube has got 20 decibels of gain, and then the output coupling network is going to split the power between the what you couple out of this oscillator and what you feed back, and some fraction of the energy gets fed back to the input, hopefully in phase, through some kind of a tuning network. And now you better have less than 20 dB of loss in that feedback network.